I think one of my favorite patterns in literature and history, a trope, is that of the unlikely leader or deliverer or king. This is something we see like in the history of the world, including our own like nation's history in literature, but of course it's also so rooted in the story of the Bible, as the spotlight always seems to get shifted away from our frail human heroes to the real hero of redemption, the Lord. In fiction, you see this pattern as a powerful storytelling device. You think of the old Walt Disney movie, The Sword and the Stone. Just a little glimpse of the legend of King Arthur. And you have the orphan Arthur. He's called Wart, if you haven't seen it in a few decades. And he's like the unlikeliest king in England because, of course, he's so scrawny and he's a nobody. But he's the one who's destined to pull that sword. Fits the character of Frodo Baggins in The Lord of the Rings. This ordinary hobbit would one day, somehow, by the end of the saga, bear the entire burden of evil on behalf of the world. In American history, I think it's hard to imagine a young Abraham Lincoln this many years later looked back upon as almost the singular kind of president that he was. Would you ever have thought the tiny, quiet, reserved Rosa Parks would somehow be a national icon and leader? In the Bible, this theme is everywhere. The Lord builds his nation not with the firstborn man's man, Esau, but with his smaller, deceptive brother, Jacob. God will address the court of the mightiest nation of the ancient world and with Pharaoh, and he uses Moses, someone who is barely able to articulate a coherent message due to nerves and fear. I love the way the Bible tells the story of David. First king of Israel, Saul, looks the part. He's tall. He's handsome. The cliche, right? Every woman wants him. Every man wants to be him. That fits Saul to a T. But then the Lord goes to Samuel and he says, I need a new king. Go to Jesse, the Bethlehemite. So he goes to Jesse. He looks at seven striking, good-looking sons of Jesse. And he says, I'm still not feeling it. Where's the one I'm looking for? You can't mean David, the runt who's out tending to the shepherds, out with the flocks. This makes sense as the pattern of Scripture because it, of course, anticipates the King of Kings. Maybe this is a pattern that is written on our hearts as human beings, because our King is not born in a palace, he's born in a manger. The one who brings about redemption and the defeat of his enemies is not with a sword, but it's with his own death on a cursed cross. Isaiah prophesies of Jesus in Isaiah 53 that he had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. There's something unmistakably gripping about the unlikely leader. Maybe it's just a hint that reminds us that true strength and might is not found in the strong and the mighty that the world looks to. True riches and power don't exist in the accumulation of wealth or influence, at least not in the kingdom of heaven. The examples I just gave are mostly unsuspecting leaders. We might look past them. The everyman who becomes an icon and a leader. Samson is different, but he's just as unique. He is as peculiar and strange a leader or as a person you will find in the Bible, as we will look at this morning. And if we didn't know the story, the expectation after last week would be so optimistic, wouldn't it? This is the judge of judges, a birth that comes from the divine intervention of God, a child that is set apart to bring some kind of deliverance to his people. This week, of course, we move into the life of Samson, and from the very beginning, the train flies right off the tracks. Samson is an incredible character. And there are typically three ways that Samson is often read. There's the minority report, which is that Samson is positive. Everything he does is absolutely faithful and righteous before God. I think it's a really, really hard, and it's a nuanced argument at times. It's hard to grapple with, though. I just don't see that as being true. The second view is kind of the negative view that's moralizing. Samson could have been great, but he sinned. You too can be great. Don't sin like Samson. If it helps you, I agree. Don't sin like Samson. The third view is that Samson is negative. It's the one that I believe. It's the one I'll teach. He's a tragic figure. But yet in his brokenness and sin, he reveals the God of the broken who saves sinners. I think subversively, Samson's not the main character of this story. I think God is. Samson is an incredible character and an incredible story. He functioned to lift the eyes of the original readers to Israel's deliverer. And if you remember from last week, who's Israel's deliverer? It's King David. He lifts our eyes to King David. But of course, what Israel needed and what we need is someone even greater than King David. We need David's son. And so Samson points finally further down the line to an even greater Samson, an even greater deliverer in Jesus. And so this is an important story. And it's also important that it is a story. We need to respect the story. If you reduce the story of Samson, like here are three takeaway points, I think you've just killed it. Otherwise, why did God give us this frankly entertaining and crazy story of Samson if we were just to go away and say, here are three things we can do in turn? So we want to look at the story. And so the story centers around a wedding. And so the outline of our sermon this morning will be before the wedding, during the wedding, and after the wedding. And we'll look at, in these times, what happened and why. What happened and why before, during, and after the wedding. And so take your Bibles if you have them. And we'll start digging in here, beginning at Judges chapter 14, beginning in verse 1. It says, Samson went down to Timnah, and at Timnah he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. And then he came up and told his father and mother, I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife. But his father and mother said to him, is there not a woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all our people that you must go to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she is right in my eyes. His father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines ruled over Israel. Then Samson went down with his father and mother to Timnah, and they came to the vineyards of Timnah. And behold, a young lion came toward him roaring. Then the spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and although he had nothing in his hand, he tore the lion in pieces as one tears a young goat. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. Then he went down and talked with the woman, and she was right in Samson's eyes. After some days, he returned to take her, and he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion, and behold, there was a swarm of bees in the body of the lion and honey. He scraped it out into his hands and went on, eating as he went. And he came to his father and mother and gave some to them, and they ate, but he did not tell them that he had scraped the honey from the carcass of the lion. All right. So last week, we begin the story of Samson's birth to his once barren mother, the wife of Manoah. Chapter 13 ends with Samson. He's growing under the Lord's blessing. And then we read that the Spirit of the Lord began to stir Samson. This word for stir, it's far more than just nudging. It's far more than just moving Samson. It's really disturbing Samson. He's awakening Samson from his slumber. The action will get going, and we begin to see what kind of man Samson is. Samson goes to Timnah, which is in Philistine territory. And the whole story of Samson is structured around the phrase, Samson went down. It's the same pattern you see in Jonah. He keeps going down both geographically, but there's also like a spiritual sense of he keeps descending lower and lower. The border between Israelite and Philistine territory was non-existent. The Philistines were unmistakably in charge. Now, if you remember back through other stories in Judges, what you'd read is that, you know, the Ammonites had oppressed Israel for 7 years, or the Midianites for 9 years, or for 10 years. If you go back to the beginning of verse 13, the Philistines had been oppressing Israel for 40 years. An entire generation had only known Philistine oppression. This was no blip on the radar. This was life. And so Samson's in Philistine territory. He sees a girl. He falls in love. He goes back to his parents and he says, Dad, go get me that girl. I want to marry her. It's just as important what his parents don't say as what they do say. What they don't say is, but she's a Philistine. What they don't say is, but Samson, she is not a follower of the Lord. Instead, they highlight the ethnic distinction, but not the spiritual distinction. Isn't there a woman from among our relatives? You really want to go marry a girl from the uncircumcised Philistines? This is the same couple who probably a couple decades before had an angel of the Lord intrude into their life and say, I know your wife is barren. She's going to bear a son who's going to be set apart from the Lord. And like 20 years later, about 20 years later, they are just as spiritually apathetic as they had been. Samson says to his father, go get her for me because she is right in my eyes. At this stage in Samson's courtship with the Philistine girl, it's a long-distance relationship. There is no FaceTime. When I was in college, it was instant messenger and email. Samson needs to make the journey. So on one of these trips to visit his fiancée, Samson's walking through the vineyards of Timnah, which might be kind of ironic because he's a Nazarite. He's not supposed to drink wine or even touch grapes or raisins. So he is in the vineyards of Timnah when a young lion roars and comes at Samson. And the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Samson, and he tears the lion to pieces with his hands. He doesn't tell anyone. He's a lone ranger. In many ways, this isolation and individualism is bad. However, when a community and nation is as corrupted as Israel is, it gives Samson a chance to be used by God in an amazing way. Samson goes to spend more time with this girl that has caught his eye, and we read a second time again, she was right in his eyes. On another trip between Philistine territory and Israelite territory, Samson goes back to the vineyard. He wants to check on that carcass because if you or I had killed a lion with our bare hands, we would want to go see the scene of the crime again. It'd be pretty interesting to us. He sees something incredible. Inside the lion's carcass is a swarm of bees making honey. And so Samson does what all of us would have done. We would have put our hands inside of a dead lion and scooped out honey and eaten it. That is so weird. What is Samson doing? He eats the honey, and then he takes the honey, puts some in like a Ziploc bag, and he brings it to Manoah and his wife and says, I just happened to find some honey. And they enjoyed it. What's going on with Samson? Are now introduced to the kind of person he is. Well, what kind of guy is Samson? He's someone that is so driven by what he wants, regardless of who gets in his way. The famous refrain at the end of Judges, which is the sermon title or the series title for this sermon series, is right in our own eyes. Israel will do what is right in their own eyes. Samson does what is right in his own eyes. He's a man that from his birth was to be set apart for the Lord's service, and yet all he wants is a wife that comes from the Philistines. But he's not just driven by selfish appetites, he's also someone who receives incredible blessing and gifting from God. A lion comes rushing at him. He tears apart a lion with his bare hands. The Lord is certainly doing something. That's the whole point of that story. I think God sends the lion, and God equips Samson to deal with it. On the other trip, Samson finds the lion carcass, and he sees the bees and honey, and he starts to sound like Adam in the garden. He sees, he takes, he eats, and he finally gives some to his parents, an echo of Genesis chapter 3. Remember, Samson was a Nazarite, which meant he wasn't to put a razor to his hair. He wasn't to drink wine or anything associated with the grape or wine. He was not to touch dead bodies. And so a big controversy is, well, could he have touched a dead animal body? Would that have broken his Nazarite vow? And I think it did. I think the emphasis is on the carcass of the animal and, of course, just the absurdity of sticking your hand into a dead lion's body to swipe some honey. And without any word of warning, he implicates his parents in what is something that we think is probably fairly nasty. So Samson, he's a free spirit. He's a rebel driven by selfish interests. He does whatever he pleases with no respect to God's call on his life, no love or respect for his parents. Yet God is actively involved in his life already, but he appears to have no God consciousness. So what are we to do with Samson and the story thus far? In other words, what is God doing? Amidst all this action in Judges 14:4, this verse stands out. His father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines ruled over Israel. What's going on here? What is the divine purpose that undergirds the human purpose? Well, we see God using what Samson intends for evil for his own good. We see here that the two communities, so to speak, are so joined together that God can't find room to enter in to pull apart Israel and the Philistines. They are content to live in bondage apart from God's rule. And so the Lord uses even Samson's weaknesses to bring about the salvation of his people. In what is brilliant irony, our author describes this rebellious, free spirit doing everything for his private gain, irrespective of those in his life, yet in the end he accomplishes the will of God. In the scene with the lion, the beast comes and attacks him. The spirit enables Samson to dismantle the lion. Why? Well, so Samson would walk by a lion at a later time when God sends a swarm of bees to make honey. Samson would then provide a riddle, as we'll just read, at the wedding party, during the wedding. And yet this picture of the lion, the picture of the bees, also gives us an ominous symbolic picture of Israel and the Philistines. Samson will go to this wedding, as we'll see in just a little bit, and he'll say there's a lion with honey and bees, which means You Philistines, who are as powerful as a lion, will be overcome by a bunch of bees, the Israelites. Even in this opening passage, we get a glimpse of God's saving purposes. Just like his uninvited disruption of Manoah and his wife, the Lord, once again uninvited, will find a way to bring about salvation for his people using his chosen deliverer and his misguided passions to accomplish his purposes. This is not an example of God sanctioning sin. It's not the Lord approving of Samson's behavior. It's God using even the sinful actions of Samson to accomplish his purposes. What does this mean for us? It's the extent that God's grace intervenes into our lives, even into the bad decisions of our lives, in order to bring us life and to bring him glory. If you've been a Christian for any time at all, have you seen this in your own life? It's not that God only takes the good. It's not that God only takes when we're obedient and when we're righteous, but God is in such control that even out of the overflow of sin that is in our hearts, God uses that and he transforms it and he redeems it. And that's unbelievably good news. Samson is no man to imitate, but he certainly gives us a glimpse of the foolishness of the gospel. The story of Samson already is telling us the story of the God who pursues the undeserving, who pursues those who frankly have no interest in being pursued. The God who is passionate for the people he loves. Israel, and even Samson to an extent, are content to live in bondage. And the radical message of the gospel is that God is not content to see his people waste away apart from him. And so he pursues them, even through a reckless, flawed deliverer like Samson. Picking up verse 10. His father went down to the woman, and Samson prepared a feast there, for so the young men used to do. As soon as the people saw him, they brought 30 companions to be with him. And Samson said to them, "Let me now put a riddle to you. If you can tell me what it is within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. But if you cannot tell me what it is, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes." And they said to him, "Put your riddle that we may hear it." And he said to them, "Out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet." 3 days they could not solve the riddle. And on the fourth day they said to Samson's wife, "Entice your husband to tell us what the riddle is, lest we burn you in your father's house with fire. Have you invited us here to impoverish us?" And Samson's wife wept over him and said, "You only hate me. You do not love me. You've put a riddle to my people. You have not told me what it is." And he said to her, "Behold, I have not told my father nor my mother, and shall I tell you?" Well, she wept before him the 7 days that their feast lasted, and on the seventh day he told her, because she pressed him hard. Then she told the riddle to her people, and the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, "What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion?" And he said to them, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle." The Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon and struck down 30 men of the town and took their spoil and gave the garments to those who had told the riddle. In hot anger, he went back to his father's house, and Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his best man. After some days of the time of wheat harvest, Samson went to visit his wife with a young goat, and he said, "I will go into my wife in the chamber," but her father did not allow him to go in. And her father said, "I really thought that you utterly hated her, so I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? Please take her instead." And Samson said to them, "This time I shall be innocent in regard to the Philistines when I do harm to them." So Samson went and caught 300 foxes and took torches, and he turned them tail to tail and put a torch between each pair of tails. And when he had set fire to the torches, he let the foxes go into the standing grain of the Philistines and set fire to the stack grain and the standing grain, as well as the olive orchards. Then the Philistines said, "Who has done this?" And they said, "Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion." And the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. And Samson said to them, "If this is what you do, I swear I will be avenged on you, and after that I will quit." And he struck them hip and thigh with a great blow, and he went down and stayed in the cleft of the rock of Etam. For those of you who are married, when you think back to your weddings, are there certain things that stick out as awkward or funny? Now, granted, there has to be a lot of time that has lapsed, but wedding disaster stories are very entertaining. We didn't have any disasters at our wedding. We did have like the worst DJ ever. We sat down with him and said, "These are the kinds of songs we want." And from start to finish, it was like Love Train and She's a Brick House. But of course, It's true. But of course, that pales in comparison to like a bride tripping over her dress down the aisle, people not showing up. I would argue that the wedding of the Philistine girl to Samson is one of these wedding disaster stories. Samson joins in what is an apparent Philistine marital tradition where the groom throws the wedding party. Can you imagine the kind of horrible weddings we would have in our culture if the groom was to throw the wedding party? The irony of also a Nazirite throwing this feast of booze should also not be lost on us as well. Well, Samson's a foreigner, and so he's starting to plan this wedding, but they don't trust him, so they provide him with 30 men who are probably like bodyguards, but they're kind of masked as his groomsmen. They keep watch over Samson with a suspicious eye. Well, the scene painted for us looks like just about any other ancient wedding celebration from the ancient world. It's basically a week of partying, and then on the final night of celebration, the marriage would be consummated, and bride and groom would begin their new life together. Clearly, part of the wedding responsibilities of the groom is to provide the entertainment. And so Samson goes, great, I'll do a riddle. And attached to this riddle will be a pretty big wager. What we'll say is, if I lose, I will give you 30 garments and undergarments. And then if you lose, you will all give me undergarments and garments as well. And that sounds very strange to us, but it most likely was some kind of an inheritance practice. Maybe if you had a grandfather who fought in World War II and he still has his like formal wear, it'd be that kind of rich inheritance garment that you would give that they were doing here in this passage. Samson offers an impossible riddle. It's really unfair. It's kind of brash because, of course, they can't know the answer to this riddle. It only has to do with his encounter with the lion in the vineyard. Out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. The wedding party becomes a nightmare. The 30 men are so angry at the prospect of losing, they go to the bride and they say, if we don't find the answer to this, we're going to burn you and your father. So she cries. She nags Samson to tell her, and she says, please tell me. And Samson, in another indication of his unsavory character, says, listen, I haven't even told my parents. Well, first of all, we've seen the relationship with his parents. He keeps distancing himself from his parents. And even if he had a great relationship with his parents, it is a terrible formula for a healthy marriage. I haven't even told my mom yet. How could I tell you? Her crying is relentless. And he finally agrees to tell her, and so she tells the men, and they recite the answer to the riddle back to him. What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? And Samson, in another show of his character, says, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle. Hebrew scholars confirm that this is just as offensive in Hebrew as it is in English. It's angry, and it's insulting, and best case scenario, it means you use my property against me. Best case scenario. Yet again, mysteriously, even amidst Samson's blind rage, the entryway is open for God to divide the Israelites and the Philistines. God equips Samson. So Samson goes 20 miles to the nearest port city of Ashkelon, and he kills 30 men, and he takes their garments and he throws them at the feet of these groomsmen. He's furious. He goes back home to Manoah's house. The father of the Philistine woman marries her off to Samson's best man. Sometime later, Samson goes back to Timnah to consummate the marriage. So he shows up with the goat, and he says, great, I'm back. Where's my wife? And his future father-in-law, who's already supposed to be father-in-law, says, you got to be kidding. I thought you left, so I gave her to your best man. And then to soften it with some good old-fashioned Philistine sexual ethics, he says, but her younger sister's even better. You don't cross Samson. Samson's furious. He takes 300 foxes or maybe jackals. He ties a lantern between their tails, and then he sends them out in pairs to zigzag through the grain fields and all of the crops and all of the olive orchards of the Philistines. They're furious. So what do? They go burn the woman and her family. This makes Samson even mad. The cycle of revenge keeps happening. And so he goes and he strikes them hip and thigh with a great blow, which is probably like a wrestling term for he totally dominates them. He then flees and goes back into hiding in the land of Israel. This wedding is a disaster, to say the least. The why again for Samson is that he's driven by his impulses. He's dead set on marrying this girl. He appears to love to be the brash center of attention at this wedding feast, and he is driven by personal gain, and he is driven by revenge. Unlike the previous deliverers of Israel, who we have read about, all of Samson's accomplishments are personal. They only have to do with him and what he wants. None of his victories have any bearing on the broader oppressed nation. They're all private. Yet, at the end of the day, the Lord's desire is to provoke the Philistines because no one else in Israel is willing to do that. And so even if it's only for selfish gain, at least Samson will stir the pot. As one commentator puts it, Samson is immature, he's incensed, he's an out-of-control youth. At the same time, he's a weapon in God's hand, being propelled relentlessly and unerringly toward his destiny as Israel's savior. The Philistines also think they're in control of the situation, but of course they're not. Samson thinks he's in control, but he's not. Everything is set in motion by the Lord. God is using Samson for good, and I think crucially, Samson is not asking to be used. God is saving his people, he's keeping Israel's enemy at bay, and they aren't asking for it either. It's so easy to lose sight of the heart of God in the ugliness of this book, isn't it? When was the last time you heard a sermon about Samson? And yet I know it's murky, and I know it's at times bizarre for us as 21st century Westerners, but yet, isn't the relentless grace of God on display in this passage? The great heresy of our culture is God helps those who help themselves. Surely that has no residence in the book of Judges and in the life of Samson. The story of Samson is more along the lines of God helping those who cannot help themselves, who have no interest in helping themselves. The story of Samson at the end of the day may not really ultimately be about Samson, but about the God who refuses to lose his children. The story of Samson is about the God who pursues his own and will not stand by as he watches his children lost in sin and idolatry. Samson is a story of the faithfulness of God to a faithless people. And in this way, it is a picture of the gospel. It anticipates the God who so loves the world that he sent not just another deliverer to clean up or even a king to restore order, but his only son to redeem lives. Let's finish the story. Then the Philistines came up and encamped in Judah and made a raid on Lehi. And the men of Judah said, "Why have you come up against us?" And they said, "We have come up to bind Samson, to do to him as he did to us." Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Etam and said to Samson, "Do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us? What then is this that you have done to us?" And he said to them, "As they did to me, so I've done to them." And they said to him, "We have come down to bind you that we may give you into the hands of the Philistines." And Samson said, "Swear to me that you will not attack me yourselves." They said to him, "No, we will only bind you and give you into their hands. We will surely not kill you." So they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. When he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting to meet him. Then the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and the ropes that were on his arms became as flax that has caught fire, and his bonds melted off his hands. And he found a fresh jawbone of a donkey and put out his hand and took it, and with it he struck 1,000 men. Samson said, "With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey have I struck down 1,000 men." As soon as he had finished speaking, he threw away the jawbone out of his hand, and that place was called Ramoth Lehi, and he was very thirsty, and he called upon the Lord and said, "You have granted this great salvation by the hand of your servant, and shall I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised?" And God split open the hollow place that is at Lehi, and water came out from it. And when he drank, his spirit returned, and he revived. And therefore the name of it was called En Hakkore. It is at Lehi to this day, and he judged Israel in the land of the Philistines 20 years. Samson's in hiding. He's hiding behind this rock. Philistines come to Judah, and they say, "We need help bringing justice to your countryman, Samson." And in a scene of what has to have like such an element of comedy, you have 3,000 Judahites coming to this rock for the one man, Samson. And they come to him, and they say, "Do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us? What then is this that you have done to us?" Samson has kept going back and forth between Israelite and Philistine territory, and he's stirring up chaos, but it's all by himself. So the Judahites go to Samson, and they are so afraid of him and his exploits that they bring an army. An army of 3,000 confronts the one man. They are on such good terms with their oppressors that they fear Samson more than they fear the Philistines. And Samson gets them to swear they won't bind him, but merely deliver him over to the Philistines as a prisoner, and they bind him and they take him. This is the lowest point in the book of Judges thus far, and granted, we have seen many low points. This is a day of shame. It's a day of shame for Samson to some extent. His own people arrest him, but it is more importantly and tragically a day of shame for the whole nation of Israel. If you go back to the very first verses of the book of Judges, Joshua, their great leader, has died, and so they come to the Lord and they say, "Who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" And the Lord said, "Judah shall go up." Behold, I have given this land into his hand. 14 chapters later, and everything has changed for Judah. They've replaced the rule of the Lord for the rule of the Philistines. Despite Samson's incredible success and solitary victory against the enemies, the soldiers from Judah are willing to sacrifice an Israelite to preserve the status quo. They betray and hand over their brother. There is no seeking the Lord's will. There is no sting of conscience. They hand over Samson to what is his certain death. And yet, what is out of Samson's certain death is the salvation of his people. Even Samson gives us a beautiful glimpse of the gospel. Samson gives us a picture of another deliverer who would be betrayed by his own people, who would be bound by them, and in his betrayal, he would save them. In his death, he would deliver his betrayers. Samson is brought to Lehi and meets the Philistines. And again, the Spirit of the Lord rushes on him. Whenever you see pictures of Samson, he's always buff, isn't he? He's always ripped. I remember somewhere in the past, some pastor was saying, I like to think that Samson looked like Woody Allen. We're never given any indication that Samson looks strong. His strength comes from the Lord, of course. And so I like to think of little Samson, who walks into the Philistine camp. The Spirit rushes upon him and the ropes around his wrist just dissolve. He breaks them off. He takes a fresh jawbone of a donkey and he kills 1,000 men. And Samson, as we might expect, sings his own praise music. He sings his own praise song. With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, have I struck down 1,000 men. And then for the first time in the story of Samson, we finally have a cry for help. Remember the cycle of the judges. Apostasy and idolatry leads to oppression. It leads to the people crying out for a deliverer, and the deliverer comes. And that doesn't happen in the story of Samson, right? They're just oppressed. But finally, Samson cries for help. You have granted this great salvation by the hand of your servant. And shall I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of the circumcised? And he calls out to the Lord. Section of the Samson story ends. He judged Israel in the days of the Philistines, 20 years. Samson is finally recognized by his people, and yet the land still has no rest. The Philistines still rule and will continue to rule. Samson's a deliverer with a higher calling than any other deliverer in this book, and yet he spends his life doing his own thing. We see this with the tragedy of the wedding and the cycles of revenge that ensue, and yet God is the main character of the story, the one orchestrating everything for the salvation of his people, equips and blesses Samson in amazing ways, and he provides Samson with incredible strength and victory over his enemies. As we wrap up here, whenever you read an Old Testament story and are looking for application, this is hard, right? How do you apply this kind of story? What in the world does the story of Samson have to do with my life and my struggles and my context? One question to ask is, who am I in this story? Most of the time, I think bad Bible reading says, well, I'm the main character. So I'm to be like Abraham when he's good, or not like Abraham when he's bad, or I'm to be like Moses or Samuel or David. I'm not to be like Saul. I'm not to be like Jephthah, not to be like Samson. But I think that answer is almost always wrong, because you and I are almost always Israel. We confess that we will serve the Lord. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, and then we let the nations and their gods move right in. So the idols of family, they don't look any different than non-Christians. Our love of money and success, it doesn't look any different than the love of success and money that the world has. A love of power and influence, it certainly looks absolutely no different. And so suddenly we find ourselves like Israel, so content with our oppressors who are slowly killing us and who are draining us of joy and abundant life that God himself offers. Man, that sounds familiar. Ultimately, Samson is the climax of Judges because he himself is the nation of Israel embodied. Samson was set apart just as Israel was set apart. Samson, as we've begun to see now, we'll see next week, he chases after foreign women just like Israel chased after foreign nations. He would be blinded and in pain just as Israel would be in pain, suffering and exile. So we are like Israel, needing a deliverer. And it's in the better Samson Jesus that we have a deliverer who for us and for our salvation came down from heaven. A better Samson who would also embody Israel, yet faithfully, set apart by God, his only begotten son. It's all here in this difficult story. But instead of chasing after the nations and their idols, he who knew no sin bore our sin and took upon himself the curses of the law. He would bear our sins upon the cross. And so like Israel and Samson, Jesus would experience the pain and suffering of exile and despair so that we might know his love. And relentless sinners like Israel and like you and I might know our God. So what is your hope this morning? What is your hope as those who find themselves with too many idols creeping in is to flee to our great deliverer, Jesus, the one who even Samson, as peculiar as he is, directs our eyes to. Let us pray. Father, this is a difficult text, one that is so unnatural to us, one that on the surface appears to speak so little of instruction to us, of where we look and seek for the profit of the text for our lives. And yet I pray that your Spirit would remind us of that mirror that Israel is for us and how we are not stuck like them, oppressed by terrible oppressors, but instead through our greater deliverer, Jesus, we have freedom. Pray that you would keep us sensitive to the idols that slowly migrate in, that creep into our lives. That we would keep our eyes fixed on Jesus. That we would keep our eyes fixed on the promises that you have given to us. I pray this in Jesus.